And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from a windowless studio in New York City, New York, where it is time, as we do, to say the three most anticipated words in the history of niche podcasting in the NBA. What up, Beck?
Oh, what up, Zach? I feel underdressed. You're like all spiffed up. You were on Get Up this morning. You've probably still got makeup on. You got like a nice sport coat and shirt and stuff, and I'm in like a BR sweatshirt.
I only dress up if they shove my ass on television. Other than that, I look like I've given up. I'm borderline Costanza on days where there's no television. I've given up. Baseball hat, hoodie, t-shirt once it gets warm.
You should just try that on Get Up. You should just, I mean, it's a morning show. People are supposed to, like, you roll out of bed and you watch, you roll out of bed, you go on TV. Like, you should be able to just look like you would normally at that
point. One adjustment I have made is I do not shave every day. If I'm 2 days is the max I'll go on TV with. 2 days of non-shaving. Three, I start to get a little, my wife likes it, but I feel like I crossed the line to, like, you could have just bothered. You could have just taken the 5 minutes.
We got Beard Zach in your Croatia photos, right? Like, wasn't one of your...
I'll shave maybe once the whole trip.
Shaving sucks.
I go Dirk in the Outback, apropos of Howard Beck.
Nice segue. Actually, before you get to that segue, because you mentioned Costanza, I had a near Costanza moment on my way here. I think I nearly trampled a pigeon. Like, I was not driving. It wasn't Costanza in car versus pigeon that did not uphold its part of the bargain by getting the heck out of the way when you...
Right.
But I was coming across a crosswalk on like somewhere around like 63rd, and I did that thing where it's like, okay, traffic's going to be coming. So I did that kind of little hop at the end from the crosswalk to the curb just as the pigeon was like coming in, and the pigeon decided to like all of a sudden like hop up half flight thing in front of me. I think I nearly kicked the pigeon.
Okay. Did you hurt it? Or is it okay?
No, but I had a moment.
Okay.
Because my first thought was, if somebody saw that, like, I kicked a pigeon, that you just look like a terrible human being. I mean, even in New York, where pigeons are basically viewed as just flying rats and are despised, I don't want to be the guy who kicked a pigeon.
I thought you were going to say when you did the hop that you did, like, remember he jumps over the pothole in the Frogger episode and loses his keys because he did a little sachet and they make fun of that.
I'm sure my keys are still in my pocket. They're there. Okay.
Last season, Costanza, it went off the rails a little bit.
Off the rails is great, though.
It's still good. It's just he's just permanently angry. Anyway, you're on because you wrote, as you are wont to do, a wonderful piece on a topic of timeliness, which is the interesting, I'll say non-traditional rivalry, but real rivalry between Dwayne Wade, who is for sure retiring, and Dirk Nowitzki, who will not say that he's for sure retiring, but I would be absolutely blown away based on what I know and conversations I've had with him, including a podcast, if he came back. I thought it was a great idea, and you got both of them. You got Riles one-on-one, which is very rare. I've never got Riles one-on-one. I've only asked a couple times, and it's never been for something like this.
I was pleasantly stunned.
And it's 15, 20 years, whatever it is, of NBA history. So, did anything prompt you to do this other than they're retiring? Was it the All-Star thing? Was it already in the works before?
No, actually, it was in the works long before All-Star, and it was in the works before they had done the jersey exchange the first time that they played each other this year. Although I led with the jersey exchange in the story. It was, I don't know, maybe back in November, October, whenever you're sitting around going like, okay, what's this season about? What are some things that without knowing how the season's going to go, like we can plot out that would be kind of fun, interesting stories. And I don't remember when or why it hit me, but it hit me at a certain stage that here we had Dirk Dwayne, who had already announced in an 8-minute video that he was retiring before the season. And Dirk, who played coy about it, continues to play coy about it, but was probably going out. Jonathan Abrams had done a fantastic story for us already on Dirk, so we didn't need a Dirk retrospective. I figured everybody was going to do some kind of Dwayne retrospective, and all I could think was, like, I want to do something on these guys because I like just great regard for them as players and as human beings, and they're both really interesting, and they've had these phenomenal careers, and I don't want to just do the waxing poetic on one or the other. And it just kept hitting me that, you know, they're rivals because of some things that happened, and they're mostly rivals because of those two finals matchups. and some things that were said and some, you know, hurt feelings and stuff, but nothing that's on the level of Magic Bird or, you know, Chamberlain Russell or
in terms of rivalry.
In terms of rivalry. Of
historical import.
Yeah. So my first thought was just not this is a rivalry. It was just it's like the most basic kind of story idea. Isn't it interesting that these guys who have nothing to do with each other otherwise, different conferences, different positions, don't play each other that often, but they've had a really profound impact on each other's careers. And so my premise going in was just to kind of explore that and just see, you know, where that led me. And unfortunately for me, while I was, you know, pondering and, you know, working with my editors on like, when do we want to do this? Do we want to do this? And working on other stories. Then they met for the first time on the court, had the jersey exchange. And I think a lot of stuff was, you know, written about then, kind of reflecting on their crisscrossing paths. But I still wanted to do it. By that point, I was already far down the road of saying, you know, I'm going to set this up. And it took a while, too, just to get each of them. I basically did a 24-hour in and out of Miami to get Dwayne and Riles. And I had to chase Dirk from here to D.C. after they played in Brooklyn because nobody wants to do it. Like, I don't blame them. People come to New York, they don't want to spend time like hanging out, you know, with me talking about 2006.
I would. I like to hang out with you.
You're already here though. So, you know, so I chased Dirk to DC, literally did the, like, I was out and back, I think within 6 hours or something. Took the train down, got Dirk, jumped the train back. It worked beautifully. And they were both fantastic. They're both very gracious about it. You know that they've had to review these things many times, and especially for Dirk. I feel like that's the interesting aspect of it. It's definitely a more painful, I think, exercise going down memory lane for Dirk than it is for Dwayne, even though the ledger says that they're 1-1 in the finals.
Similarly, I had Dirk on my podcast 2 months ago, a month and a half ago, and I had to go to Cleveland to get him. Because
if he was here, you want to be in New York.
He wants to see people that are better than me, better, more interesting people than I, as my dad would correct me. It would be interesting to see if Dirk would even entertain these sorts of things had they not won the championship. And whether it was over the Heat and Dwayne Wade or not, whether he never capped his career. Because that Dallas team, I've said this many times, it's going to be a team that's remembered forever. I think even relative to most championship teams. And there are many, many reasons for that, Dirk being one of them. But one of the reasons is that it was not quite a one-off because the Mavs have been one of the best franchises in the league for a long time until this little fallow period we've got here. But, you know, they were coming off first-round loss after that first finals against the Heat, 2006, which Mark Cuban has referred to as the scene of the crime in Ian Thompson's book. Lost first round, lost second round, got spanked in that second round by Denver, lost first round, and have lost first round or not made the playoffs every year since. And in between have this one sort of magical run.
One shining moment, if you will.
One shining moment. I still haven't watched the Lakers one shining moment that was going around.
It's really good.
Yeah.
I hate one shining moment. I am a complete, like, just Scrooge when it comes to.
Oh, that's not nice.
It's a terrible shining moment.
Oh, you reach for the star. That's my favorite version.
It's incredible. This is a universally embraced piece of utter American
cheese. Okay, where are you on Round Ball Rock
thing? On what?
Round Ball Rock, John Tesh, NBA.
Round Ball Rock is like canon. It's
okay,
because
the podcast was going to end.
No.
Was going to end.
I would not.
There would have not been any more.
I'm not messing with John Tesh. Round Ball Rock is precious. It's important. I wish it were back. I have long thought that either ESPN or my corporate overlords at Turner should bring that thing back. It needs to be part of, like, I'm glad, like, NBA radio uses it quite a bit. It needs to be more part of our modern day NBA fabric. I miss Round.
There's going to be a generation.
But one shining moment's trash.
I can't get there. But anyway, so, it would be interesting to see how Dirk would approach this without that, the ring. And because, you know, because everything that happened going to the Outback, literally with Holger, which he talked to you about and talked to me about, and living out of Holger's van after going grocery shopping somewhere and going out to the Outback. It's a journey because it has an endpoint. And if it has no happy endpoint, it just kind of becomes a journey to nowhere.
Yeah, look, at the point where Dirk loses in the finals after being up 2-0 and that crushing defeat and the bitterness of it because of all the officiating controversy, everything else, and then a year later to be a 67-win team and lose in the first round in one of the greatest upsets in NBA playoff history, the losing to the We Believe Warriors, and winning the MVP and getting the MVP after he was already out. I mean, I don't know that you could conceive of a more painful 12-month span of an NBA career for an NBA superstar. Just in terms of the competitive side of it, forget anything that's happened to anybody personally. That competitively, that was crushing in so many ways. And I think certainly it was legitimate to wonder at that time whether you were Dirk himself or any of us, is he ever going to get back to that point? Is he ever going to have a chance to win a title? Are we going to view him in the way we view certain legends, where it's like, oh, well, they had a nice career and they put up a lot of stats and they were great, whatever, but they couldn't win the big one? And in Dirk's case, it comes with all kinds of other nonsense that goes with it. Oh, you know, can you win with a jump shooting big man? Is he too soft? Is he too this? You know, all the European.
Yes, no, yeah. No is the answer to those questions.
So, yeah, that was, if we had never seen or heard from him again at the finals and you were on that stage, no one would have been surprised. And we would have been.
The hole in the wall at Oracle Arena. From 2007, We Believe, when they lose and he throws the chair like 20 feet up in the air and leaves a hole.
That's high.
That's not funny anymore. Yeah. It's a little bit funny, but it's not as funny.
The fact that he signed it for them, the fact that he embraces talking about it and reminiscing and all that other stuff goes all the way back to, or all of that goes back to what you were just saying a minute ago, which is winning it in 2011. Not only is a crowning achievement for his career, but I think it's this big exhale, like, okay, I can look at the large expanse of my career, all the highs and lows, and have perspective and be able to talk about it without it being that painful. Now, I think you and I both experienced this in talking to Dirk, that you can still see how much he's affected by the memories of 06, but it's not nearly the scar that I think that it would be, to your point, if he doesn't win in 11.
How much did he say to you? Is there anything on the cutting room floor? Because I know you always keep track of your cutting room floors, as do I. He likes to use the word frosty for some reason. He used it on my podcast, too, about his relationship with Dwayne over the years.
Great word.
I got the sense from talking to him, and let's say from the facial expressions in the room during that podcast that were of people that were not Dirk, other people who were there, I got the sense that he's soft pedaling that out of politeness and perspective, and that there was some real, there was something beyond frosty that maybe has thawed now because they're both sort of NBA geezers living out the end of their career. So who cares? You know, let all grudges die. I think it was worse than frosty. I think there was, at least from Dirk to Dwayne, I think there was active enmity.
Which is a great word. I agree. And no, he didn't let on any more than...
He's too smart. He's candid, but he's too smart to go down that road.
And I think also, you know, again, things have softened over time and they've had this moment. It's funny, you know, I opened the story by, you know, kind of just describing the scene of them exchanging jerseys and smiling for the cameras. And I tried to describe it in a way that points at this, but without hitting you over the head with it. They're not really smiling in a big, happy, kind of embracing, warm way. Dirk's kind of toothy. It's a smile, but it's kind of a taut smile. It's not a wide smile. Dwayne's not showing his teeth at all. He's just kind of got a toothless grin, and the grin is not that wide. And if you look at it again, It's just a matter of when the shot was snapped, right? Maybe they were smiling a little more before or after that snapshot, although I've watched the video and I don't think they were. It's a moment, and it's a nice moment, but I think there's still a little bit behind those smiles and the gritted teeth of like, yeah, you know, you were kind of a dick to me back in the day. I mean, you know, this of course goes back to, and this is talked about in the story. I didn't want to go down the rabbit hole of officiating and all that stuff, and I didn't necessarily even want to go too much into the why they didn't necessarily like each other, because it's kind of weird. Like, if you think about it, like, nobody dislikes Dirk Nowitzki. Like, there's nothing polarizing or controversial about Dirk as a player or a person. You might disagree about whatever his career, his resume, whatever. Dirk's a great guy. Dwayne's a great guy. However, you look at Dwayne Wade. Like these are not guys that inspire a lot of, to your word, enmity. It doesn't make sense that they would be enemies because they're both good dudes. But this is what competition does, right? So Dallas loses in 06. Mark Cuban in particular, but the Mavs as a whole, complain about the officiating. They go way beyond
complaining. He complains
complaining.
About it again in your story. He's not backing down.
No. It's well, let me
13 years later.
Bookmark that. Let's come back to that.
Okay.
But that really ate at the Heat and certainly Dwayne, because you're basically saying our championship is fraudulent, that we got it, that it was handed to us by the officials. And so it's like 7-8 months later or whatever that Dwayne gives an interview to, I think it was all of the Heat media hashtag, saying, you know, look, Dirk didn't lead them right. They lost because Dirk didn't lead them right. So now it's a total shot across the bow. Now this is he's firing back because he feels like they were taking shots at him by putting it on the officiating, but he's now making it kind of personal about Dirk. So I think that's where it all starts.
That was one of the – so I had forgotten about that until I read Ian Thompson's book, The Soul of Basketball.
Same. Great
and
book.
And that quote where he says essentially Dirk's a bad leader. Yeah. Dirk came up short. He's a bad leader.
Yeah.
I read that in the book. I was like, did that just – how is that not like one of those things you just remember all the time?
Like a bigger yeah. tentpole kind of thing.
I mean, that is too yeah. – first ballot Hall of Famers, one going for the throat yeah. of the other. Yeah. I mean, that's a crazy one.
That one is, and it's rare. We don't see that too often. You might see guys, you know, take little shots at each other or, like, you know, playful stuff, or even if it's a little bit cutting, it's not – that one was pretty deep. That cut pretty deep, and I think that's where it all really begins, and then it festers for years. And then, you know, like the – Dwayne and LeBron making fun of Dirk being sick during the 2011 finals and coughing on camera as they're
walking. Like they were trying to be jerks.
Yeah.
Like they reveled in being jerks.
They were playing up to their villain status at that time. And, you know, Dirk calls it childish. But I think under the surface, if that had happened in a vacuum, it wouldn't have mattered that much. That happened within the context of what had already gone on between Dirk and Dwayne. And I think that's what made it seem like more than it would have been otherwise. Otherwise, it would have just been a silly, childish thing, as Dirk framed it. But to your point about Cuban, I went to Cuban when Dallas was here, and I said, listen, I'm doing this thing about Dirk and Dwayne, their intersections, their career. It's a very open-ended question, by the way.
Yeah.
I said, you know, they're rivals in a weird way, but they're not. They don't play the same position. They only met twice in the finals, and other than that, blah, blah, blah. And, but that, my go-to phrase was, I feel like they've just had a profound effect on each other's careers for guys who didn't really face each other that often. That was how I went to Carlisle, to Cuban, to Dwayne, to Dirk, everybody. And Mark immediately jumps into officiating and how, you know, it was taken from them and everything else. And there were multiple quotes on that subject. I only used, I think, one or two of them because I did not want to get just sidetracked into that whole rant. But the funny thing was that in researching the story, ESPN.com had done a phenomenal oral history of the 2006 finals in 2016 on the 10-year anniversary. And within that story, Cuban says, this is the last time I'm talking about it. And after this, I'm burying it forever. I'm just never going to talk about this again. So the last thing I expected, having read that, going to him a month ago and saying, hey, Mark, I'm just doing a story about Dirk and Dwayne and their intersection. The officiating! And he starts going out. I'm like, oh, holy crap. I did not see that coming.
People, one of the most important things we do for our health every day is brushing our teeth. And most of us don't even do it properly. Quip is a better electric toothbrush created by dentists and designers to make sure you are doing it properly. And it's simple, affordable, and it makes brushing enjoyable. It has little sensitive sonic vibrations that are gentle enough on sensitive gums. Why? Because people brush too hard sometimes, or some electric toothbrushes are too abrasive. Not Quip. It is a built-in 2-minute timer with pulses every 30 seconds so that you switch sides and brush for the dentist recommended 2 minutes. If you actually sat here and counted 1 to 120, you'd realize 2 minutes can kind of feel like a long time. You might be shortchanging it. Up to 90% of us, in fact, don't brush for a full 2 minutes or don't clean evenly. We're lefty or righty heavy. That's why I love Clip and why they're backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. That is a lot of dental professionals. That's an NBA stadium arena of dental professionals. Quip starts at just $25. I always imagined a high-end electric toothbrush would be like triple digits at least. $25, that is, if you go to getquip.com/low, my last name of the name of this podcast, right now, and you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/low. So every time you write a big piece like this, you get access to so many people that there is always one quote that is going to be the aggregator quote. Can you guess which one I think it's going to be?
Oh, man. I mean, Cuban on the officiating is a natural.
That'll be one, but that's not the one I'm thinking of.
Huh. No, I don't know.
Riley saying that for a period of time around the 2006 yes. title, Dwayne Wade was a better player than Kobe Bryant.
Yes. Yeah, that was pretty good.
Did you perk up when that came out of his mouth?
Yes. Riley's really interesting. So I don't know Riley that well, to be honest. You know, my years covering the Lakers, obviously he's long gone. I get to New York, he's long gone from New York. We never really crossed paths in a major way. And as you know, during these last however many years in his post-coaching tenure in Miami, Riles is, you know, he meets with the Miami media a couple times a season, occasionally comes up to talk about some issue or talk about, you know, when Chuck Daly passed or something. Like, you don't hear from him that often. And so I don't really have a relationship with him. But on this one, it was kind of a, you know, I was talking to, so quick aside, shout out to Tim Donovan, great PR guy for the Miami yes. Heat, and Sarah Melton for the Dallas Mavericks, both of them, you know, long time among the best PR people in the league, and they were both phenomenal in helping me out in this story. When I'm texting with Tim Donovan, I say, listen, so here's when I think I can come down, or he's telling me when to come down. I said, I'd love to get Spoelstra and Pat if he's available. It was just kind of a throwaway line in my text thinking, I gotta ask.
Start the ask high. You gotta start the ask high.
I don't know if I should actually say this, but I had almost zero expectation I was going to get him. And Tim texts back, basically says, "Yep, we're all good." And I'm like, "All three of them? Yeah. Okay. Cool. Thanks." So I got down there, and you know, I'm always the pessimist. I'm still expecting like, oh, it's going to turn out he was busy or whatever. I'll get Dwayne, I'll get Spo, I'll hop on a plane and fly back. But no, Tim says, follow me. He says, we're heading to the Inner Sanctum. He actually called it the Inner Sanctum. And there I was in Pat's office.
Music starts playing in the background.
Probably Godfather music, yeah. Right? And we sat and chatted for a while. He was fantastic.
Are there big leather armchairs and leather bound books? What's in the office?
I remember mostly like I was fairly locked in on just like finding my way to a place to sit and then just talking to him and paying rapt attention. But there is like a collage on this one wall of like all these highlights and, you know, news clips and all that stuff. And
is there any visible hair product?
Not that I saw.
He's such a legend, man.
He's
such a legend.
There are certain people I've come across in my years of covering this league, as I'm sure you have, that you just think not only like this guy is just a natural badass, but just this aura about them. Certain people, like Jerry West, got an aura about him. Even if you never knew who he was or what he'd done or that he was a logo, Jerry projects something, and so does Pat. And certain guys, you know, Bill Russell, if you're ever – I've never spoken to Bill Russell, but just being in the room with Bill Russell, you just feel something.
I can't speak to Bill Russell.
No, I think I would be completely – I'd be a mess. Riley just exudes cool and exudes wisdom. And, you know, we talked for, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, and he was phenomenal. And a lot of it was him just kind of going down certain tangents himself to compare and contrast these guys to other eras and whatever. It was just great historical stuff. It wasn't germane enough to the story to pack it all in there. I wish I could have. But he was just a pleasure to talk to.
He says, for about yeah. 3 years span, Wade was, in Riley's view, quote, the best player in the world. He could stop there. Stoppable. You've made a statement. Stop. You could stop. Dwayne was better than Kobe at that time, Riley says. He had a better year by having the impact on winning in the finals and the biggest moments on the biggest stage, and you get that moniker. That, I was surprised he went there. In fact, so I want to talk to you about Wade. I want some time in the offseason to reflect on Wade for a couple of reasons. I feel like he's the great unknowable star of like the past 20 years. I just don't feel like I know who Dwayne Wade is as a human being. What is he about? What's he like? What's his personality? I mean, I know certain things about his game, and he's a rugged player, and obviously he's symbolic of the Heat culture and all of that. And you get glimpses of his off-court life. I just don't feel like I have a grasp of him the way that I do of someone of his stature. And just his stature alone, I think, is a matter of interest to me, because he doesn't come up enough, I don't think, in the greatest shooting guard of all time below Michael rankings. And Wade versus Kobe at their primes, I think, is an interesting debate. And then you look at how many top three finishes do you think Dwayne Wade had in MVP voting?
I'm going to say less than three, like one. Yeah.
How many first team All NBAs do you think he made?
Ooh, that's a good one. I'm going to say three.
Two.
Okay.
Kobe made first team All NBA like 9,000 times. I can't even, there are so many here, I can't even count them. It's just, he's had a strain, and there have been injuries. He's been injured here and there because of his, eight times down, seven to stand, fall down eight, stand up eight.
That was the commercial, right?
Something like that. I mean, and so his counting stats aren't maybe as impressive as they could be given some of the time he missed. And then, of course, he takes a backseat to LeBron for the latter part of his career. He's just had a really interesting career that maybe because of the era it took place in, or because a lot of guys sort of have their brief flicker of maybe I'm the best player in the league, and then someone else comes and takes it, and like LeBron did. I just feel like I haven't quite put my finger on him yet. What did you come away with this?
Yeah,
thinking?
It's interesting because first of all, so in terms of like where he ranks all time, I mean, isn't it generally universally agreed upon he's third in the shooting guard rankings behind Michael and Kobe?
I guess.
I mean, has anybody else made a case that somebody else should
be third? It depends how you characterize Jerry West,
yeah.
I think, who is constantly, I mean, maybe because of what he's done since his playing days, is constantly overlooked in like all those debates. I think he's overlooked in the greatest Laker debate, not to say he is the greatest Laker of all time, but he's not in that
discussion
conversation. Yeah. Maybe Dwayne is universally the number three guy, and I think how he stacks up with Kobe player for player, prime for prime, is actually kind of an interesting conversation. But in terms of accolades and statistics, counting statistics anyway, it's not close. But in terms of efficiency statistics, it is close.
Yeah. And, you know, there's, to your point, there is a lot that's, I think, I don't want to say unknowable about him. But Dwayne, interesting, in talking to these guys, I talked to them, I think, like literally 7 days apart. And it's just very different talking to Dirk, talking to Dwayne. I mean, they're, you know, like as any two people, I guess. But Dwayne is so polished and is so, you know, it's going to be a great interview. You know, he's going to say some interesting things. He's going to be earnest. He's going to be, it's earnest with a polish on it. Like, it feels like Dwayne was always made to be in these situations. Like, he's just great on that stage. And in fact, you know, I think a lot of us have felt over the years that like LeBron being with Dwayne in Miami made LeBron a better, you know, media presence, because Dwayne always, kind of invited it and had a certain, enthusiasm for it that I think kind of brought LeBron in, because LeBron was not as great in his first run with Cleveland. So Dwayne's just natural with that. Dirk's got that low key kind of monotone. I'm going to sit back in the chair with the microphone off the stand at press conferences and be a little bit, he's not that expressive, but Dirk's emotions are so much rawer. They're really raw, and he's letting you in when he says, yeah, like I thought Dirk's quote to me, I'm sure he said some version of this before, but this thing where he's basically saying like, you want to just like not get out of bed. You don't want to like go out. You just feel like everything is just over. It was all a waste of time. And you just don't even want to leave the house. And like, that's very raw. And I can't see Dwayne saying it in that same way. And so maybe Wade has just not dropped the facade long enough in the course of his career for us to know him in the way that you're alluding to.
He's definitely more of a celebrity.
Yes.
That's part of it. But like Carmelo Anthony is a celebrity, and I feel like I know Carmelo Anthony. I feel like I know who he is and what he's about. I know his personality. I know his mannerisms. I don't feel that there's something kind of untouchable about Wade that is interesting to me that I would like to look at once we get through 8 months of playoffs and 8 days of crazy free agency when half the league is going to change teams and everyone's going to be upset. Once we get to mid-July, maybe in Croatia, I'll spend my Croatia time thinking about Dwayne Wade. My wife would love that. Honey, I'm just going to go to the hotel bar next door and think about Dwayne Wade for a few hours. Can you take care of our daughter?
I said
Dwayne Wade. Yeah, Dwayne Wade. No, the basketball player. The him. Yeah.
I'm going to advise you against that.
Yeah. What else was fun to you about this story? We're reliving the 2011 finals. There's interesting stuff in there about Dwayne says losing the 2011 finals made me greater. And then he explains that by saying it made me give the reins to LeBron, which is a storyline that's been sort of talked about ad nauseum. But it was interesting to hear him frame that as a step increasing his own greatness.
Yeah, because I think there's a certain feeling like, you know, in that 4 year span, or, you know, obviously they didn't think it was going to be only 4 years at the time they got together, Wade, Bosch, and LeBron. I don't think they really expected to win not four, not five, not six, not seven, but they certainly expected there were going to be some ups and downs in there. So whether you win two out of four being year one and year three or year two and three as it happened, I think they thought that there was going to be some combination of wins and losses like that in the finals. I don't know. I got the sense when being there that they truly believe, and Spoelstra said this too, and I don't think they ended up quoting Spoelstra in the story, but that it was just something that just kind of had to happen. It, just like they had to start off 9-8 and have everybody freaking out before they could kind of get themselves righted and figure out what the right chemistry was, the right, pecking order, whatever. And then they had, maybe they had to lose for LeBron to understand what he really had to be, because obviously he got killed for the way that finals went.
It's one of the all-time. Now, Dirk has said this before. He says it in your story, like maybe we were lucky to catch them in their first year.
Yeah.
He's saying that because he's self-effacing, but I do think he believes deep down that there's a kernel of truth there, that they were lucky. Now, I also, all the focus on the LeBron meltdown, I think, took away a little bit from how good Dallas was in that series and how smart defensively they were. That was Tyson Chandler at his absolute apex. That was Deshaun Stevenson, Jason Kidd, still wily enough to guard every position. And on, Marion. And they had a great defensive game plan. They executed it. LeBron was in his own head, but they shoved him deeper in his own head because they didn't let him out. If they were even just an okay defensive team, he would have gotten out of his head and they shut him in there. But he was really in his own head. And when he retires, which all of a sudden doesn't feel so far off given what's happened this year, when he retires, all of the noise and yelling and screaming about LeBron and how he was a choker and he couldn't win the big one and blah, 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 it's all going to come down to one playoff series, and it's that.
Yep.
Because he was a beast in 2007. He was a beast in 2008. The Celtics wanted no part of him in 2008, and they were so relieved to get by him despite 40-something in Game 7 when Pierce also had 40-something. He was a beast in 2009, and the Magic just were better. They were a better team. They were a terrible matchup for Cleveland. 2010, something happened. That's the last Cleveland year. Something happened. Not sure what it was.
Somebody knows, and they're going to write it eventually.
Somebody knows. It's not me. Somebody knows. But statistically, he was good, and he was at least like 90% engaged. The 2010 finals, he just flat out wasn't there. He wasn't there. And it's the real black mark on his career.
Yes, and I think really the only significant one.
The only one. Yeah. And there was so much screaming before they finally won that Kevin Arnovitz, at the buzzer of 2012, rather, when they won, had an article ready and posted saying goodbye to all that. And it was just essentially, thank God we don't have to go through this charade anymore because he won. And the charade was only real for that one series.
Yeah. So while we've been discussing this, I wanted to find it because I did not use this quote from Spoelstra. This was interesting. Maybe I should have jammed it in there somewhere. The story was getting too long. Spoelstra about 11 says, quote, "I think it was probably meant for us not to succeed in that first one. It really set the table for the next 2 years, a level of pain and experience that allowed us to win back to back. It happened all that first year because of how that team was put together. Of maybe we might not have realized just how challenging it is to win, no matter what your team makeup is." So there he is. He's basically saying, this was kind of fate, basically. We had to lose to figure out who we were in order to win the next two. And I think that that's kind of what Dwayne telegraphed a little bit and what he said to me as well.
He's Dwayne, and Dwayne is fascinating. And I suspect at the end of this year, a journalist who actually knows him somewhat in Miami, I'm just guessing, I'm hoping, will write something. Like, I would read a book about Dwayne Wade, like a real good book about Dwayne Wade. I would read in Croatia. I'd bring it with me. go read the book. Anyway, the piece is called, it's on Bleacher Report today. It is called The Ballad of Dirk and Dwayne by the one and only Howard Beck, and you should all read it. Howard, that was a great piece. I don't want to ruin any more of it for people. Let's talk about some actual present day things.
Sure.
Well, like, this is it's a present day thing.
Yeah. And they're playing for the final time tomorrow night.
That's right, tomorrow night. And boy, the Heat are in the thick of what has suddenly become, I don't want to talk about this yet, maybe we'll talk about this for a second, a five-team race for three playoff spots between Brooklyn, who is in first in this five-team slap fight at 38 and 37, and the Hornets, who are 35 and 39, but have the potential to win every tiebreaker and finish the season against the Magic, I believe, who are right above them, currently in eighth place in the standings. The Nets have an absolutely brutal schedule the rest of the way. They've had a brutal schedule for like a month now. Charlotte is in play for the eighth spot, which I did not think would happen. And we're going to look back at that Jeremy Lamb shot in Toronto.
Insane.
My in-laws were at the game. My mother-in-law was devastated. She's still talking about it, devastated. My father-in-law does not like sports and was dragged there because they needed another person to go because someone canceled. He was just happy there was going to be no overtime. that changed the playoff odds by itself, like more than any other event. So the Heat, that every game for the Heat is important, and that loss last night against Orlando at home was a crusher for Miami. But we're reaching the end of the season. Everybody wants to know who the MVP is. Who is your MVP, Howard Beck? Do you have one yet?
As you know, I'm a stubborn stickler on this thing. I'm going to be one of the last people to hit, assuming that I have the ballot. Well, the ballots aren't in our hands yet, right? Unless you know they went out and
I don't believe that we have received them.
They're not out yet. It's usually April 1st, 2nd, 3rd, somewhere in there. I'm always among the last to hit send to send that thing to Mark Broussard at NBA PR on the very last day, which is the day after the season ends. So we do have 8 to 10 games left here on the schedule, and I am probably going to go down to the wire on my ballot on all of these things because certain ones are going to be tough. MVP, I mean, I don't mind saying where I'm leaning. I will never say it's final. I'm leaning hard Giannis.
Well, that was a good tease right there. I'm leading hard Giannis.
I don't think I actually planned it that way. I'm leaning Giannis very much at this point for a variety of reasons. But it's going to be a really close race. It's definitely Harden and Giannis in the top two. Like, we don't have one of those years where this is going to be three or four guys that everybody's trying to figure out. Excuse me, my computer is doing annoying things. This is absolutely a two-man race as far as I'm concerned, and I think most people. So it'll be interesting to see how many people go one way or the other. To me, it's Giannis at this point. Again, things may happen in the next few weeks, mostly because of the totality of his work, including the defense. The Bucks are the number one defense in the NBA, and Giannis is the primary reason for that. And the Rockets simply are not.
That's correct. They are not the number one defense in the NBA.
nor really all that close. That matters. Being great from 1 through 82 matters, which is, again, goes back to my stubbornness about not declaring a winner in January, February, March, or even March 27th as we're recording this, because the whole season matters. And so, yes, Harden went on a tear that saved their season, but they had a season that needed saving, and he's responsible for that as well. They're 11-14 on December 8th in 14th place in the West, and that was before Chris Paul had gone down. So you can't even blame it on injuries. I mean, I don't know what you blame it on. Carmelo Anthony? I mean, that always struck me as a bit of a stretch.
It feels like 12 years ago that Carmelo Anthony was on the Rockets. I was looking at their on-off data by team, just among many tabs I had open for MVP purposes to see what Harden's ratings were. And I saw Anthony, Carmelo at the top. I was like, wow. First of all, it's a negative number. Second of all, that was this season.
Yeah.
Did not work out.
No, sadly. So look, you know, that first 25 games, which is a significant chunk of the season, that matters too. And the Bucks have been great from day one. Giannis has been great from day one. And as you know, I also, you know, my definition for MVP is always the individual excellence plus team success formula. The Bucks are going to have the best record in the NBA. They do have the best record in the NBA. They may cross 60 wins. The Rockets are going to get to the 50-win threshold, which I thought they might not get to at all, in which case I would have pushed Harden down even further, because I believe that 50-win threshold is really important in the MVP discussion, because with one major exception a couple years ago, 50 wins has been kind of a requirement for the last 35 years. But they're going to get there, but they're going to be at, what, 52, 53 wins, somewhere in there, and the Bucks are going to be at 60, and that matters too. So, yeah, for all those reasons, I'm leaning very much toward Giannis. We'll see if anything changes in the next few weeks.
I'm interested to see how the seedings in the West turn out and if voters care. And by that I mean, can Houston get up to number three, which would seem valuable because it's a way to avoid the Warriors, except the Warriors and the Nuggets are now tied atop the Western Conference. So there is a world in which three does not avoid the Warriors in the second round. Three gets you the Warriors. Now, I think the Warriors will win the number one seed because they have a much easier schedule, and they currently lead head-to-head 2-1, although they have one game left against the Nuggets. And if the Nuggets win that game, it defaults to conference record, which is very close between them right now. So TBD. But if the Warriors are first and the Rockets have a chance to get up to third, they trail the Blazers now by a game, and the Blazers have the better head-to-head record, but the Rockets have won their division, and because the NBA stupidly still has divisions, that somehow matters. If the Warriors get one and the Rockets stumble to four, and we get to the end where they're in a position to know urgently that they would like to get out of four and they don't, yeah. I wonder if that will matter to some people. If I'm going to vote for Harden, there's part of me that would like to get them to three if that ends up mattering.
Yeah, I mean, I generally feel like, again, going back to precedent, almost all MVPs for 35 years, except for one, top three in the conference, 50-plus wins. I would like to see the Rockets in the top three for MVP purposes if James Harden is going to be getting major consideration for the top of the ballot. I do think it matters.
Now, if we get there and somehow with three games left, the Warriors are like an 80% chance to come second, I'm tanking to four. Like, they should tank to four.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't feel like we've seen a lot of that in recent years, but the focus of tanking has been so much more about the lottery and the draft and not so much about the tanking in and out of matchups. But you're right. This is one where you could very easily see the Rockets trying to manipulate that.
I have been leaning Giannis all season. Everyone knows I like defense very much. I think defense is very important. I think Harden is somehow both simultaneously underrated and overrated as a defender, and I know that it's impossible to be, but he's not a good defensive player. Off the ball, he's terrible. He doesn't box out, and you've seen some smart teams kind of realize that he doesn't box out and send his man to the glass. They have to switch all because of him, right? Because he doesn't want to do any work. But I don't think he's got enough credit in this regard. His post defense is legitimate.
Yes.
It's
saw it again last night.
He's one
Giannis.
Of the best post defenders in the league statistically, by the eye test, by the deflections, all of it. It's not fake. It's not because bad players are posting him up hunting mismatches. He's a good post defender against good players in the post. And so it's tempting to say Houston has to scheme the way they do to protect him, but that scheme wouldn't work if he weren't good at this one thing.
Yeah.
He has to be really good at that one thing.
Yes.
It's not like he's bad at everything and they scheme around it. They do scheme around him, but they scheme around him in a way that accentuates the thing he's actually good at, and that scheme wouldn't work to the degree it works at all if he were bad at it.
And by the way, while we're on the subject, let me dismiss a couple of tropes right offhand because I've seen them cycle through Twitter in the last 20 hours.
This is your big mistake
hours.
In life. You're looking at tropes on Twitter. It's a big mistake.
It's among many mistakes I make, almost all of which involve Twitter. If Harden doesn't win it, it's not going to be because voters are quote unquote bored. First of all, you'd have to be able to mind read 100 voters to know that, because even when any of us in this position explain our votes on Twitter or in columns or blogs or elsewhere. Nobody ever says they're bored. So
are there blogs anymore?
I don't know. Does anybody use that word anymore? Even?
I don't think there are blogs. I think you just telegraphed yourself as an old person.
Oh, damn it. Again. No one. It's not because of boredom. I voted for Harden each of the last 2 years. He lost the first time to Westbrook. He won the last time. If I don't vote for him this year, it's not because I'm bored of Harden or bored of voting for him. And it's not because I suddenly think his game is suddenly worse. If anything, it's even better. It's because each season is its own thing. And again, back to my definition, like, you know, your team's win total matters. The being great from 1 through 82 matters. The consistency matters. Giannis's defense matters. All these things matter. So it's just a different consideration.
Trope
it's not about boredom.
The trope I have seen in that is not the boredom one, which I don't think anyone's actually bored. Maybe Harden should shave his beard as like a last minute, like eye catching vote getter.
I think the world would come apart.
The one I've seen is the Rockets fans saying, well, you can't have voted for Russ in 2017 because of some incredible statistical feat on a 40-something win team and then not vote for Harden in 2019 when he has an incredible statistical feat because he is on a 40-whatever third seed. That's bogus to me for exactly what you just said. Every season is different. Now, I am not subject, nor are you, to such alleged incongruence because I did not vote for Russ 2 years ago. I don't think it's like a crime that he won 2 years ago. I think it was a perfectly legitimate vote. He averaged a triple-double. His clutch shooting was outrageously good. And he, as Rachel Nichols has very cogently said many times, picked up a franchise on his shoulders that had been punched in the gonads by Kevin Durant's decision to leave and could have folded, not folded literally, but like that could go in a very bad direction.
There were many potential reasons to vote for Westbrook that year. Neither of us bought those reasons.
But if you vote for Westbrook then and don't vote for Harden now, it's not a crime.
No.
It's not incongruent. And also, Giannis is having an outrageous statistical season in his own right in terms of points in the paint, shooting percentages, steals, blocks. It's an unprecedented combination of stuff.
Which again brings up something that runs through the thread of all three of these guys, which is making history does not equal MVP, okay? Having a historic season, having a historic stretch of games within a season does not equal MVP. The MVP is not there to reward you for setting records. The reward for setting records are the records. That was my case that I made it about Westbrook averaging the triple-double and setting the record for triple-doubles in a season a few years ago, and it's the case I would make about Harden now. Yes, Harden is having a historically incredible season based on certain parameters and based on the streak he had of 35-point games and all this other stuff. Giannis also is having a historic season, which, by the way, Harden also had a historic season the year that Westbrook had a historic season. They were just differently...
There were different digits.
They were different digits.
Different amounts of digits in one category by one digit.
But Harden also had something that was historically incredible that year. And he has this year. And so does Giannis this year. History does not equal MVP. There's another one to throw out the window. Last night's game, head-to-head, as people were suggesting on Twitter, and I responded on that one, it's not about the head-to-head. Like, it didn't matter.
I made my decision solely based on that game.
It did not matter who won head-to-head. That's not a thing. People are creating things that I don't think used to exist. MVP has existed as a media vote for, I don't know, how many decades. A lot of these things are recent conventions that people, I think, have created on the fly. You've got to have a moment. There's got to be some defining moment. You know, you got to have these moments. And then
You say one shining moment?
Or possibly several shining moments. But that was part of the Westbrook narrative, too, a couple years ago was, oh, well, he had all these game winners down the stretch and these clutch shots. Okay, fine. Those are important, too. But, like, you don't need a moment. Michael Jordan won however many MVPs, you know, 5, 6, whatever. You could not tell me a single moment that defined those seasons, nor historical records that defined those seasons. He was MVP because he was MVP, because he had the best season on the best team. I mean, anyway, people are overthinking this and they're creating new categories of what defines MVP, that just did not exist historically. This is all because I spend too much time on Twitter. I'm sorry.
Here's the case for Harden. And it's a case after leaning all season towards Giannis. Sometime in the middle of like another 57-point game last week, I began to lean the other way. And now I'm like buffering in two different directions, like frozen. And every year I do this, I poll as many people as I can around the league, coaches, executives, about whatever question is most pertinent awards-wise in my mind. This year it happens to be MVP. And one person responded that they would vote for Harden. And I said, I asked about Giannis. And this person said, Giannis's case for MVP is too intertwined with him, with Bud's case for Coach of the Year. And by that, he meant this. But there's an interesting, okay, I don't quite buy that, but it's interesting, and here's why. What they're trying to say is that Bud and John Horst crafted an ecosystem specifically to, on offense, specifically to limit the impact of Giannis's one weakness, his jump shot. Four shooters and you. That's it. We're all in on that. And I think the point this guy was making was, you don't have to do that for Harden. Harden is 100% scheme and teammate proof. You have a rim runner, have a rim runner who can't shoot. You have no rim runners, that's fine too. You just want to play one-on-one all the time, that's fine too. You have a rim runner and two non-shooters, or like a rim runner and a couple guys with unproven three-point track records, we'll make that, he can make that work. He is completely system and scheme proof on offense in a way that maybe two other guys in the modern NBA have been, and I think he's even taken it to an extreme degree with the step back three. There's just nothing you can do. And so you see these games, like, it now happens all the time. You're watching the Bucks last night. I don't know that I've ever even seen Curry guarded with this kind of extreme, where they are giving him 6-foot layups, not at rim layups. By the time you get to the rim, somebody will be there. But they are literally rolling out the red carpet like, dude, just dribble as far as you want. Like, dribble to the area where, like, the entire history of basketball is based on preventing you from doing that. Do it. And what will happen is you'll get pretty close. Capella's guy will come over. Another wing player will come over to help Capella. And then the other wing from the other side will come in to help on you. And all of a sudden, four dudes are guarding James Harden at once, 6 feet from the basket. And he still has a pretty, I just don't know.
He's got a great floater that's going to beat you anyway.
And I just don't know that anyone has been literally ushered to the rim like this before, because no one can figure out a better way to do it.
Yeah. All of that is a phenomenal case for Harden. And I don't dismiss any of it. I would only, you saw me like kind of wrinkling my brow a little bit about the idea that you can't, like, as if Bud being coach of the year and Giannis being MVP are somehow mutually exclusive. We can only give credit to one guy or the other.
I don't think this person meant that.
Yeah. I've heard that other years where people try to say, well, it can only be one or the other, because otherwise you can't say it was the coach if it was the player, and you can't say it was the player if it was the coach. No, it's like this is all symbiotic relationships. That's even, I wrote about this a couple of years ago about what a perfect match Harden was to D'Antoni and D'Antoni to Daryl Morey, and that whole, like, everybody being in alignment there with a certain philosophy and a style that maximized, you know, Mike's philosophy, Harden's game, Daryl's analytics driven strategy and roster building. You're right. Their roster, they can do different things no matter who's on the floor. But that's not to say they didn't build a roster that is made to maximize James Harden.
It is, but I don't think they feel as urgently about, I mean, they want to play a particular way because Mike wants a screen and dive center, and that works well with Harden. But I think he's almost ecosystem independent. I don't think it matters.
No, which is a great point that you could almost drop Harden into any context, any roster, any team, and he would still just be.
He doesn't need a pick.
Yeah.
Like, that's, I guess it's a fancy way of saying that he doesn't even need a pick. Now, Giannis doesn't need a pick in some degree too, because he just dribbles and spins and then dunks, but he'll occasionally meet a defender that can bother him.
Right. And if you lay off him, he's not going to just destroy you from the 3-point line. Which, interestingly, you know, when you look at, I think both effective field goal and true shooting, or maybe it was just true shooting, that Giannis wins in one or both of those despite not having a 3-point shot. Like, Harden feasts on 3-pointers, which, you know, definitely boosts your advanced field goal percentages. And Giannis does it without that because he's just such a high percentage guy on twos and obviously gets to the line a lot.
We also have to fill out a 5-man ballot. And while
that's where it gets hard.
Well, and on the one hand, it's a 2-person race, and really what matters is who gets the top slot. But I do think hard about 3, 4, and 5 because all it matters. It's historically, I just went and said, how many top 3 finishes does Dwayne Wade have? And it was 1. Like, we're going to look, those things matter.
Yeah.
And so I have eight candidates for five ballot spots. Are you ready?
Okay.
Giannis, Harden, Paul George,
yeah.
Nikola Jokic, Damian Lillard, Joel Embiid, Kevin Durant, and Stephen Curry. And Curry's going to be a little short in games, but we can talk about that if you want. So I have
all those same guys. You can see where I have Kawhi with a cross through him. Yeah, and you can see I have Curry circled there. But I have those same eight names. Yeah.
So I guess my question to you is, would it be strange to have a five-man MVP ballot and no Warriors?
It would be.
It feels wrong.
No, this is the conundrum that's been created ever since Durant went there, right? We have a hard time parsing out, well, is it Curry or Durant who you give the credit to? Is it both of them? Are they taking away from each other? Both of them statistically are so good. And yes, Curry, we have a games played, a little bit of a games played issue, but they're both so off the charts, especially Curry and his efficiency, that you cannot dismiss them. Their numbers are better than some of the other guys we're talking about. And their team's record is better than some of the other guys we're talking about. Better than Dame and Portland, obviously. Better than Embiid and Philly. But it'd be almost impossible to jam them both on there. Where I come down on this right now, and again, I don't know how I'm going 3, 4, 5 specifically or what order. But I do think it's Curry over KD. Because we've seen when Curry was out, KD just can't lead them in the same way. They're not the same team without Curry. He is still the most important engine of the Warriors. And maybe that'd be different if the team had been built around KD. I don't know. But I think we've seen that when Curry is out, the Warriors are much more vulnerable than vice versa. So Curry and KD stats are phenomenal for both guys. If it's going to be one of them on the ballot in that 3, 4, 5. Position, I think it's Steph.
Statistically, they've actually, for the first time, been okay without Curry when Durant is on the floor this year. Just what in those minutes, Durant on, Curry off. This is one of the first times they've been.
Yeah, and I was referring mostly to when he was out.
Curry also have Mark Medina had a good piece on this today. There, particularly in a season with so much drama around the Warriors, Curry's presence and his leadership. It just has to count. It has to count in this calculus in a big way, in a bigger way than I think for almost any player in the league. Him holding the team together is strong, but him being the voice that if there's a conflict between literally any part of the team and any other part of the team, he is the glue who can go in and figure out how to fix it. That has to matter.
Agreed.
I also, it's going to be really hard to leave Lillard off. Yeah, Lillard, I think Jokic is a lock to get on for me, and I think PG is a lock to get on for me. So that really leaves, we're talking about one spot.
So
I think
you're going Curry versus Dame versus Embiid. Or
yeah, no, and Embiid's in there too. Embiid's shooting percentage and turnovers, I just don't know if it's enough. And it's like Lillard is making one hell of a case. They are, the difference between when he's on the floor and when he's off the floor is 16 points. It's one of the biggest gaps in the league. Paul George, I think, has the biggest one at 17. It's good. There's going to be someone who's it's really hard to leave them off. And Embiid, for everything I just said about the shooting percentage and the turnovers, the Sixers are flat bad when he doesn't play. Bad. They've been bad for 2 years when he doesn't play. It doesn't matter if Simmons is on the floor. Now, he's attached at the hip to Redick, so Redick deserves some of that credit, and their two-man game is so good. But, we've yet to see the Sixers, with the exception of that run at the end of last season when Embiid was hurt and Simmons went crazy and they played mostly bad teams.
Yeah.
They're mostly just not very good when Embiid is off the floor.
Yeah. No, he's for all those reasons, I had to put him down, and he has to be under consideration. And the Sixers, where are they now? Third? So, they're in a good range there. They're, I think finally about where we expected them to be. I don't want to leave Embiid off. In the same way you don't want to leave Lillard off.
And Lillard, everything I said about Curry applies to Lillard. Yeah. Lillard is an absolute rock and a stud.
Phenomenal.
And maybe the best culture setter in the entire league.
Every single feature that you've seen written on him in the last couple
of
years.
It's all true.
He's just fantastic. And the way that guys respond to him, react to him, tone setter, culture setter, all of that. And that stuff should matter in the MVP discussion too. It's not just stats and it's not just wins. It's your presence. it's going to be really tough. I don't know how it's going to shake out for me. I'm with you that I think Jokic and Paul George are fairly essential. Although the Thunder's late season fade here is fairly troubling.
It is going to be interesting to see where they end up and how that hurts him, or whether he built up enough equity in the first 68 games of the season.
He probably did, because the way that we have these minute-to-minute discussions now, because of Twitter, talk radio pods, everything else, we you know, the MVP discussion, people do start to get, I think, kind of mentally locked into a certain place at a certain point, even though there's season to go, and you shouldn't. The Paul George thing, it was like a few weeks ago, everybody was talking about, oh, he's definitely third, and maybe he's even pushing into the race with Harden and Giannis. I don't think that was ever the case, but because again, it's an 82 game thing. It's not just what you were doing for that month, but the late season fade also kind of matters. And that's, you know, he had the shoulder issue, so it's injury related possibly, but the Thunder themselves also just haven't been that great. And again, there's a team component to the MVP race. It's not just your individual stats. So, I'm not certain that Paul George will be third on my ballot. He will be on my ballot, but I'm right now, because of the way that they're, What are they, like, lost 11 of their last 16? I can't dismiss that.
Listeners, you know that getting tickets to sporting events for friends and visitors used to stress me out. There were too many sites to check on the secondary market. Am I getting a good deal? Am I getting the best deal I can get? What if there's a better seat and I just forgot? Well, guess what? SeatGeek has solved all of those problems for you. It pulls millions of tickets into one place. Only have to visit SeatGeek and that's it. And you can easily find the best seat you want for the price you're willing to pay. They have a super easy to use color-coded system. Green dots for good deals, red dots for less good deals. It's very interactive and easy to see where your seat is, whether it's obstructed, unobstructed, all of that. And best of all, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. SeatGeek should be your go-to ticket source for everything: sports, concerts, Broadway shows, theater, comedy, all of it. Best of all, my listeners get $10 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app. Enter promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. That's promo code LOW. Bam, $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, life's an event, and we have the tickets.
Last question, and then we have to part ways. You said you had a hot take. You said you're going to get takey about your all-NBA guards. Now, I don't want to do a whole all-NBA show, but I do want to do all-NBA guards, because that is where there's so much at stake in terms of not only money, but how the money makes those teams think about those players and their place in their long-term future. So to review, I did this last week with Russillo.
Yes, I listened to that.
I have 4.5 guards who are locks for the six spots. Obviously, Curry and Harden. Lillard is three. Kyrie we could argue about, but I have him as a basic lock. Gets a little shakier every time the Celtics win without him, although they beat the freaking Cavs in their American Gladiators jerseys last night. and Russ, I do have. Now, if you want to unlock him, I'm cool with that. I'm not wedded to him as a lock. And that leaves a whole pile of dudes. A pile.
It's a pile.
A plethora of piñatas. A pile. what do you got? Well, first of all, do you disagree with my locking?
Curry, Harden, lock. Absolutely, positively. That was easy. Dame, lock, easy. Kyrie, at the time that you and Russillo were debating this, and Russillo, I think, was not on, he said no to Kyrie.
I'm so mad about Kyrie.
I was with you on that one. Kyrie was a lock. A week here later, I waver a little bit on Kyrie, but as of right now, I'm still pretty sure that Dame and Kyrie are the second team. So that's four. Four are locked. It's a disaster for the third team. And the hot take I alluded to.
Yes.
Before we got, started rolling on this. And you know, I'm not Mr. Hot Take.
I don't
take
know what the hot take is. I'm very excited. Let me put on my goggles.
It doesn't feel as hot anymore because you just kind of hit
oh,
it.
Oh, no. No Russ?
Maybe not Russ.
That's
I think to the masses, that will sound like a hot take, and it will sound like something like, oh, you're just trying to. No, like Russ's efficiency numbers in particular are terrible. The Thunder are, again, as I said, 5-11 in their last 16. I just want to point this out on Russ, and I'm not positive I'm leaving him off, but, you know, Kemba Walker and Bradley Beal have great cases to make. Klay Thompson, Klay and Steph are the only guards in the league averaging over 20 points who are shooting 50% from two and 40% from three. And Kyrie's close at 398 from three. So there's three guards who in the entire league, 20 plus points per game, 50% from 2-point range, 40% from 3-point range if you round up for Kyrie. It's not that far. Klay, Kemba, and Beal are the other guys I'd be considering against Russ. Russ is, among all these guys, he's last in 2-point percentage. He's next to last in 3-point percentage at 28. He's last in effective field goal percentage at 46. I ran a couple different versions of this just to see how it would pan out. Oh, and he's also averaging 4.6 turnovers a game, which is a lot. And his free throw percentage. Russ is shooting 65% from the line for a guard. That's just horrific. 31 guards who are averaging at least 2 free throw attempts a game. That's not even that high of a threshold. 31 guards who are averaging at least 2 free throw attempts a game. Russ is 30th in free throw percentage. The only one he's ahead of is Ben Simmons, who I had not mentioned, but should be part of the discussion for third team as well. 33 players, period, regardless of position, average 20 points or more a game. Russ is dead last in that group in effective field goal percentage. And yet he's 4th in field goal attempts. I mean, efficiency has always been my knock on him, and for I think for a lot of people, the knock on Russ. It's really pronounced right now. And that's certainly mattering in the standings and in their performance and in the fact that they, while looking like they were going to be and should be a top four team in the West, are now going to finish in the bottom part of the bracket again. I think all that matters. Less so the record. I don't place as much emphasis on record for all NBA as I do for MVP, but it's in there somewhere.
Well, where it will be, where it was going to factor into people's votes, I think, is third team center. Where I think if you pulled 100 coaches, Gobert would have a 75-25 edge over Towns because of record and this impact on winning. Whereas I think if you pulled 100 media members, it would be closer to 50-50 or a little more pro-Towns. Maybe I'm wrong, though.
And yet, as everybody in Salt Lake City will tell you, those same coaches did not reward Gobert for winning when it came to All-Star reserves. They voted in Towns over him.
True.
And I mean, that's a point of some bitterness in Utah. And it may well be again if Gobert loses out to Towns in all NBA.
And so speaking of record, Charlotte is 35-39 in the East. Huzzah. Okay. So record is not – I don't hear a lot of with Bradley Beal, the Wizards are 30-45, and they're really a special kind of 30-45. They are really a dumpster fire on top of a trash fire on top of the Titanic. I mean, they are just a spectacular.
Can we work a nuclear
spectacular. They can't just fail. They have to fail with comedy. So they're 30-45, and I hear, well, you can't give all NBA. To Bradley Beal, if they're 30-45, they stink. Guess who else stinks? The Hornets stink. They're 35-39. They stink. Yeah. They just stink a little bit less.
And if you go through the history of all NBA teams over the course of decades, you're going to find plenty of guys who had great stats on bad teams. It's not a disqualifier.
So I'm going to give you a candidate whose name is not being mentioned at all. Literally, you have not said him. I did not say him last week on my podcast. Who statistically deserves attention if Kemba Walker's in play at 35-39 in the junior varsity, and Bradley Beal's in play at 30-45 in the junior varsity. Mike Conley should be in play.
I thought you were going to say like Chris Middleton or like
no, Mike. Well, D'Angelo. You can go the other way and go that way if you yeah. want. Mike Conley has had an outstanding season. By the numbers, he's better or as good as all these guys. And the Grizzlies have been, like, shockingly competitive since trading Marc Gasol.
Yeah.
And he has been outstanding. Nobody is bringing him up because I think there's this perception that, oh, the Memphis, they're just too terrible. Like, they're way too terrible. Their team is like an NBA Mad Libs. They just made up a team halfway through the season. Jonas Valanciunas, yeah, come on. Justin Holliday is on the team. You know, Joakim Noah, he's a character. Bring him on.
It's a really random team.
It's the most, so they have this perception of like this random tanking flotsam because they're 13th in their conference. Guess what? They have, as of right now, a better record than the Washington Wizards, and they'd be 3.5 games behind the Hornets. They're functionally the same as, well, they're not, the Hornets have a negative 0.8 point differential, whereas the Grizzlies have negative 2.4, so they're not functionally the same, but their number is red. Both their numbers are red. They're negative and red. And so I don't think I'm going to vote for Mike Conley, but I literally haven't heard his name because I think people lump the Grizzlies in with like the Suns and the Knicks, yes, and they're not there.
Random Tanking Flotsam either needs to be the name of a punk band or a podcast. Somebody out there, name something Random Tanking Flotsam.
I believe they play the Warriors tonight.
The Random Tanking Flotsams?
Yeah, I believe they play the Warriors. They just beat the Thunder, like, and it wasn't that hard of a game.
No. This is the perfect Mike Conley. Like, this is the epitome of Mike Conley in the way that we regard him. He's perpetually overlooked, and I just overlooked him in this discussion. And you're right, he's not going to make. Somebody somewhere might throw him on an All NBA.
I might throw him on.
Just for the fun of it.
You know, he's
earned it.
I said last week I was leaning Beal because statistically, it's an overwhelming
the 25-5-5 thing. And if we're going to keep doing the, like, let's, you know, make up random statistical thresholds,
well,
plug him into basketball
shooting percentages, but are way better,
yes,
than,
no,
Kemba's,
yes,
and things like that.
No, he's legit. Beal's
but
legit.
I will say what I left out last week, and I've watched the Wizards a couple times since then for God knows what reason. I guess I enjoy horror movies and and whatever. His defense this year has taken a step. His defense has been really bad. Like, he's never been a good defensive player, but he's been average, maybe a little below average. He has sunk with the rest of his team to just really, really bad.
But I think that's what happens with bad teams.
Yeah, but it is. And so, like, he's not the biggest problem on the Washington Wizards defense, but he's a problem. He's not part of the solution. He's been very bad defensively. You know, Kemba is a liability because of his size, but he tries really hard and is usually in the right place. You know, none of these guys, Conley's just good now. He's not outstanding like he used to be. You know, so you can eye of the beholder, but like Beal's defense has been not just like, it's been very bad.
Yeah. The other thing I'll say about all NBA, again, traditionally, and I think we talk about it differently in the last 5 to 10 years with more emphasis on defense and more statistics that we can kind of grab, even if those statistics are flawed. I think all NBA is mostly about stat generators. It is mostly about, like, we still think about elite players in this league as being elite offensive players. Right or wrong, that's still what defines them. It's why Towns will probably win over Gobert. And, that's not to excuse Beal for poor defense or anybody else, but, you know, we're not considering Dame's defensive liabilities when we're talking about him for second team, or Kyrie's liabilities for that matter. Like, we give a lot of guys a lot of passes on this stuff until it comes down to crunch time and we need to, like, eliminate somebody, and then we start to bring in their defense.
Well, that's why Klay, I think, actually has a lot of momentum.
Should.
Although he's a little overrated defensively, he's very good. And
he's really important to them defensively, put it that way.
Sometimes you really do feel like he's sneakily the most important warrior. Like, the only guy they don't ever have to worry about Klay on either end of the floor, just does his thing. But he was just so ice cold by his standards for 25-30 games, and it took a long time.
And yet,
for Klay to get, and yet
he's, as 40%. 40% from three, 50% from two, and averaging over 20 points a game. One of three guards in the NBA doing it right now.
If there's a Buck guard, by the way, that deserves the third team spot, it's not Middleton, it's Bledsoe. Bledsoe has had, and last night was, I think, the capper.
Oh my God.
The capper for him.
He was a monster last night. That was, if you had just watched, you turn on that game to watch Harden and Giannis, but if you just watched Bledsoe last night, you would have been phenomenally entertained and impressed. He was great.
Okay, Howard, you gotta go. The Ballad of Dirk and Dwayne on Bleacher Report, which is a website on the internet, not a blog.
not a blog.
It's a great story. Everything you do is great. Howard, we always appreciate you. The people love you. The people demand more. Howard Beck, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Zach.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.